Okay, here we go. Stand by.
3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
There's a lecture series at the Great Courses Plus that ties perfectly into today's broadcast. It's called Monsters Within, and it talks about the horror genre, whether it's film or whether it's literature, and how it sort of reflects the human condition, commentary on everything from our fear of death to crime to wars to tapping into the darkest parts of ourselves, you know, that part underneath the civilized person. Horror, often a commentary on the human condition, and Monsters Within will fascinate you. And if horror and monsters aren't your thing, I've been enjoying Dr. Anthony Martin's major Transitions in Evolution. It is a series about how life, including human life, evolved on the planet. I mean, the hard science of evolution, so good. You can watch or listen for free. The Great Courses Plus streaming right into your life, and right now, you get free access to the entire course library. I mean, all of it, all courses completely free if you use my special URL. So start your free trial at thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. Villisca, Iowa. Little more than a stop on the local railway, Villisca, the name, means pretty place. But some people whispered that the town's name was actually taken from the Native American word Waliska. Waliska means evil spirit. The year was 1912. The modest Villisca ranch home was owned by the Moore family, Josiah Moore, Sarah, his wife, and four children. June the 9th had them again at church, this time for Children's Day service, where the kids performed various speeches and dramatic performances. And at the end of the evening, the 10-year-old daughter, Mary Catherine, asked her parents if two of her friends could stay the night, and they agreed. And the family walked home about three blocks. This was about 9:30 p.m. The next morning, the next-door neighbor, her name was Mary Peckham, she was out hanging up her laundry, and she noticed that the Moore home was unusually quiet. Nobody doing chores as they usually would, the kids were not heading out for school, nobody tending to the livestock. So Mary went over and she knocked on the door. There was no answer. She tried to look in the windows, but the shades had been drawn. An employee of Josiah Moore, his name was Ed Selly. He arrived early, about 8 o'clock in the morning, to take care of the livestock. And seeing the worried neighbor, Mary, standing in the yard, he knocked on the door, received again no answer, and then he used his extra key to let himself inside the house. And within seconds, he was screaming. He was screaming for Mary to get the marshal, get the marshal, get him here as soon as you can. The phrase caught on like wildfire, murdered in every bed. Josiah and Sarah Moore, their four young children, their two friends, murdered in every bed. with a blunt side of an axe to the head. The axe was swung so high, there were gouge marks on the ceiling. So much violence, so much blood. Strangely, there was no sign of movement or struggle, as if each victim had been killed while still sleeping, completely unaware. Word about this traveled down the street and through the town so quickly that a crowd immediately gathered. Some of the morbidly curious pushed through the protests of neighbors to walk inside the murder scene, trampling over fragile, important pieces of evidence. One macabre report had a man taking part of Josiah Moore's skull as a souvenir. Who had done this unthinkable thing? And why was the home left in such a strange arrangement? They found a fuse to a bedroom lamp inside a dresser. The victim's clothes were all pulled over their bloody faces. The mirrors had all been covered. The window shades had all been drawn. Perhaps the most bizarre item was a 2-pound slab of meat draped in a dish towel and left in the room of the murdered children's friends. The murder axe was still there, partially wiped clean. It was leaning against the wall. The investigation was doomed from the start. The crime scene contaminated by crowds, the dogs unable to even locate a scent. Many people suspected, some even accused, but the killer or killers were never found. This story actually happened. It was so sensational at the time that some newspapers actually placed it above the then-waning story of the sinking of the Titanic. The whole Midwest was talking about it. Thousands arrived for the funeral procession, so many people that it required the attendance of the National Guard. The Villisca Axe Murder House stands today. It's actually on the National List of Historic Places. Completely restored after over 100 years. In fact, it's open for tours, even overnight stays, which can cost you over $400 per night. Of course, people who are curious about ghosts have been keen to stay there. Reports say the tours have been cut short by falling lamps, the voices of children, moving ladders, flying objects being touched on the skin. In 2014, a paranormal investigator spent the night. At 12:45 a.m., alone in a bedroom, he was stabbed in the chest. Doctors and police determined that the wound was self-inflicted, but others say that his hand had been forced. The house is real. The murder was real. The horror is real. The ghosts of the Villisca Axe Murder House, the spirits of those sleeping who died by an axe head to the skull, whose murders have never been avenged? I cannot say. Perhaps for a fee, you can stay the night or part of a night. You can look them up on the internet and you can make your reservation and you can stay in that house as long as you wish, at least until you hear the creak of a door, the axe head dragging on the floor, the touch upon your skin, the calling back to that nightmare of June 9th, 1912. Murdered in every bed. Murdered in every bed. Murdered in every bed. Footsteps running through the streets, monsters seeking special treats, witches hearing doorbells ring. My, you're just a little thing. Pirate, mummy, werewolf too, I've got something just for you. Here you are, the witch would say. The children laughed and ran away. The house next door was dark and still. Thin cobwebs lined the eerie hill. No lights were shining in the dark, but from inside they heard a bark. And at the window they could see someone watching. Who could it be? A bony finger pointed down. The children screamed and turned around. Next came the house with a fiery torch. A scarecrow stood on the front porch, and a man dressed up just like a clown with a basket of candy hanging down. The kids ran up to get some treats, jumping over leaves that lined the streets. Their bags were filled, they could hold no more, but the children kept going from door to door. At the end of the night, they all went to sleep, and Mom and Dad went through their keep to check the loot for their favorite snacks, while the kids get to keep the rest of their packs. They don't need all these chocolates, Dad would say, and he took some out and stashed them away. So black cats and bats and pumpkins, too. A happy Halloween to all of you. That poem called A Halloween Poem, written by Christine Sandra Sanchez. It is our annual tradition. It is Ghost Stories 2020. Once again, I will climax the broadcast with a totally original ghost story, something that's unlike anything I've ever attempted before. It's an ensemble piece. So thanks to all of my voice actors and contributors and consultants. Yes, I had consultants on this one. And that will constitute the entire last segment of the broadcast, and I hope you enjoy. You know, ghost is one of those words that we use all the time, but we don't really know much about it. Like, what's a ghost? Where does that come from? The Oxford Dictionary defines ghost as a spirit of a dead person that a living person believes they can see or hear. Ghost actually comes out of the Old English word ghost, and also the German noun Geist, which is itself apparently a translation of the Latin word for spirit or spiritus. Ever wonder why we say something is ghastly? Well, ghast comes from ghost or Geist, a fearful or frightening spirit. It is ghostly or ghastly. Remember that people used to believe that whenever you died, your last breath was actually your spirits or your ghost coming out of your body. That was your soul that was leaving you. Remember the story of Genesis in the Bible? Adam's essence was created. It was breathed into existence by God. Adam's body was formed out of the dust, but his soul, it was breath or spiritus. And religions are loaded with spirits. Obviously, the most popular one on earth is the one linked to Christianity, the Holy Spirit, or as the Pentecostals like to say, and they call it this even today, they call it the Holy Ghost. The history of humankind is loaded with stories about ghosts, much of it related to ancestor worship. In the minds of many people, you didn't actually die until you were forgotten by the living. So perhaps haunting people was a way for the spirits to survive. You know, they would remind other people, hey, I'm still here. I'm still around. Don't forget me. If you forget me, I may cease to exist at all. Of course, there are vengeful and hateful and spiteful evil people in the living world. So it stands to reason that the spirits of those people could also be terrible, wicked things, envious of the living, demanding sacrifice to appease their unrest. These ghosts were often called revenants, and living people would often carry out elaborate rituals to appease them. Food and drink would be left out for the spirits because revenants were said to be starving in the afterlife. And if their hunger and thirst was not appeased, the revenants would carry out great horrors upon the living. Every generation has had its belief in ghosts. The early Mesopotamians believed in Irkalla, this realm that existed between the earth. It was called the Land of the Dead. And those ghosts were trapped in the Land of the Dead, trapped there forever, unless they were needed to come back to Earth and haunt the living to correct some kind of wrong. So these spirits in the land of the dead were given a kind of temporary pass to rise up and appear and act and react in the physical world until their mission was done. And then they would descend again into their prison beneath the crust of the earth. The early Egyptians simply couldn't abide the thought of non-existence. You know, this idea that there's only one life. They thought that dead spirits traveled to a place called the Hall of Truth, and you'd be judged by the god Osiris and 42 otherworldly judges. And they would judge you with a feather. They would weigh your heart on a scale against something called the white feather of truth. If your heart was lighter than the feather, they would reward you with an afterlife of joy and bliss, a kind of paradise or heaven. But if your heart was heavier than the feather, they would cast you onto the ground and you would be devoured by a hideous monster, after which you would never exist again. The ancient Greeks believed that the afterlife had three distinct realms. And to get to these, a coin would be placed in your mouth after you died. The coin was for the ferryman. You needed the ferryman to carry your soul across the river Styx. And your spirit or soul would again be judged. You would be given paradise or punishment. Of course, there were the early Celtic ghosts, which we so closely associate with Halloween, the early celebrations of Samhain, which means summer's end. Those were rooted in the pagan belief that the calendar year revolved like a big wheel. And around the end of October and early November, this veil between the physical world and the spirit world would get very, very thin. And this would allow the dead to temporarily pass through the veil and walk among the living. People would be ready for this. They would expect this every year. They would prepare meals for their departed friends and relatives. A great party or celebration was given. They'd bring in cattle for the slaughter. They would salt meat for the winter. They would burn the bones in bone fires. By the way, that's where we get our modern word, bonfire. Not all Samhain spirits were benevolent, so the living would wear masks so that they would not be recognized by the dead. They would try to fool these spirits, and they would leave special items on the fronts of their houses so the spirits would take the items and not bother them further. Of course, the festival of Samhain provides the roots for our modern-day Halloween traditions of costumes, masks, bonfires, tricks, and treats. Halloween itself actually is not a pagan word, it's a religious one. When the Roman Empire conquered the Celts by the first century CE, and then they mandated Christianity as the official religion, I think that was 4 CE, the church did what the church usually does. It latched on to popular existing beliefs and customs, stuff that the people already did and practiced and enjoyed. And it took those things and rebranded them for their own purposes. And so Samhain became All Hallows or Hallowmas, All Souls Day, which became All Saints Day. So instead of dealing with the spirits of dead relatives, you were actually honoring the spirits of dead saints. That was the 1st of November, All Saints Day, and All Saints Eve, of course, became All Hallows Eve, or Halloween. It's an interesting backstory for what has become for many the most celebrated holiday of the year. Birmingham, Alabama. The city was founded back in 1871, just 5 years after the end of the Civil War. The country had been devastated by those 4 years of intense fighting, over 600,000 people dead, so many buildings ravaged, burned, blown to bits. As the smoke cleared after the Union victory, the time for reconstruction began. That reconstruction required a tremendous amount of something called pig iron. Pig iron is also known as crude iron, and you make it by smelting iron ore in a blast furnace. Ironically, pig iron isn't very useful for construction. It's very brittle, has a high carbon content. But you could find pig iron in things like wrought iron, railroad tracks, ships, and even artillery shells in the First World War. To make pig iron, you needed a big factory with a very large and very hot blast furnace. Colonel James Withers Sloss was an industrialist, and he saw an opportunity here. He'd served as a colonel in the Confederate Army, and he emerged from the Civil War to make some pretty big money in the coal mining industry. In fact, he was one of the richest men in the state of Alabama, and he was going to get even richer by manufacturing pig iron at his newly founded company, Sloss Furnaces. A year after he broke ground, the factory was up and running, and he employed hundreds of men who worked the blast furnaces 24/7. The demand was high, and the money was pouring in. But working those furnaces was a hugely dangerous job. I mean, imagine it. You're standing there, you're right up against a 2,000-degree equivalent of a lava flow. Your body recoils against the searing heat. You're constantly blinking through the sweat as the liquid metal and sparks and thermal force push you backward. Well, it's no surprise that the late 19th century had few protections and safety policies for the workers, and many of them burned to death in terrible accidents. Then the new century began. In the early 1900s, James Sloss hired a new foreman, someone to oversee operations. The new foreman's name was James Wormwood. The workers called him Slag. He was a cold man, a cruel man, absolutely without empathy, no consideration, no compassion for those he supervised, no breaks for the men, no holidays, no chance to catch one's breath or find a safer, better method to do something. He pushed his men to the edge without mercy, demanding they take dangerous risks to increase production. In the short years that Wormwood was in charge of the furnace, 47 men were killed on site, and many others were horribly injured. Working for this man was like playing Russian roulette. Anytime he ordered you into a situation, there was a chance that you would not live through it. It was in 1906. James Wormwood, the supervisor, was standing on a platform near the top of the highest blast furnace, and he lost his footing, and he fell. He fell into a cauldron of melted iron, the temperature so hot that his body caught fire while he was still in the air above. His body was consumed by the molten metal. And then he was gone. Jump forward four decades to 1947. The factory was still in operation. Three supervisors were found unconscious in the boiler room. When they were revived, all three men had the same story. They were approached by a man who was badly burned, a man who kept shouting, "Get back to work! Get back to work!" The man struck them, each one of them, and knocked them to the floor. In 1971, there was a security guard. His name was Samuel Blumenthal. He was on his rounds when he said he saw a figure on fire. A figure that tried to push him up a stairwell, pounding its fists on his body. When the guard was taken to the hospital, doctors treated fist-sized burns on his face, neck, arms, and torso. Those burns could not be explained. Now, it's possible that old Slag, James Wormwood, was simply too inhuman to go quietly. But it's also rumored that Slag didn't just fall from the platform on that day back in 1906. There are so many whispers about that day. about the 150 men who suffered under his boot, tossed daily into harm's way without any care for their well-being. And, well, finally, they had had enough. We can all picture the scenario. We can all fantasize about doing the same thing. Wormwood screams again, "Get back to work, get back to work." And finally, the men turn toward him and they say nothing. And they grab him by his flailing limbs, and he shouts, and he bites, and he claws as they pull him off the floor, toward the stairs, toward the upper platform, over the boiling metal. They ignore his pleading and his protests and excuses and promises and curses and desperation as they square their jaws toward his. And the scalding heat at 70 feet up is still almost too great to bear. But the men shout in defiance as they lift old Slag over their heads. And they collectively heave his screaming body into a fiery grave. Sloss Furnace became famous for that story. And people today take tours of Sloss Furnace. Halloween parties have been hosted there. I mean, here in the 21st century, it is a place that remains steeped in spirit and mystery. If you walk the grounds tonight, you'd want to look around in every direction. You'd want to listen closely for that hollow voice shouting, "Get back to work! Get back to work!" For this ghostly entity, more than a century after his death, he remains locked and burning and suffering inside his own 2,000-degree hell.
The Ghost by Richard Jones. I live in a house with no windows. A black curtain hangs on my door. The voices of conscience torment me. I live in a room with no floor. There's dirt in the corner I can't see. There's water that runs down the wall. There are mice in the attic above me and rats playing games in the hall. I live in a house with no windows and sleep in a room with no heat. The darkness of life that surrounds me keeps out the sounds of the street. I wake when the shadows have fallen and walk when the memories cease, when purpose in life has no meaning and only the wicked find peace. Each night you sense that I'm by you. You feel my breath as you sleep. You hear the faint creak of the floorboards as out of the shadows I creep. I live in a house with no windows. I live in a house that's now yours. It's my voice you think that you're hearing. For I died in this room with no doors.
Oxford, Ohio. Brad Culp was a student at Miami University, and the students loved to talk about one of the most haunted places in America, a haunted place that was right under their very noses. Brad Culp was fascinated by this story, so when he became a reporter for the campus newspaper, he decided to investigate, and the story he investigated went like this. In the 1940s, there was a young couple in love. They lived in a rural part of town, and her parents did not approve of this young man. They forbade contact. They told their daughter she couldn't see him. Don't acknowledge him. Certainly, she was forbidden to love him. But love him she did. And so every night after the parents went to bed, she would sneak out of her farmhouse, and she would gently open the door of her parents' parked car, and she would flash the headlights 3 times. Her love would then ride a motorcycle from a long distance to the very end of her driveway, far enough away that the engine of the motorcycle couldn't be heard inside the house. The single headlight would advance toward her, and then the two would steal away into the night. Night after night, they would not be kept apart. No one knows what exactly happened, but on one of those nights, after she had flashed the car headlights those 3 times and waited in anticipation, she could see his single beam of light suddenly shoot in 12 directions and then go off the road completely, and then flicker amid the weeds and barbed wire and wooden fence posts far away. She ran toward that light. Had the tire slipped? Had an animal jumped in front of him on the road? Something else? She would never know for sure. But she approached in horror as her deepest love's lifeless body hung there, wrapped within the wire. The barbs cutting into his neck, the fence post piercing his heart. His eyes and his mouth open, his last moment frozen in time. The young woman spent the next year in heartbreak. She was inconsolable. Shortly after that time, people started reporting something unusual on that old and rural road. There was a single light which would appear off in the distance and then grow larger and larger and larger until it was almost upon them, and then, poof, it was gone. This was the story that reporter Brad Culp wanted to pursue more than half a century later. And so Brad and his girlfriend traveled down to the old farmhouse after dark, and they quietly pulled their car onto the property and turned it around 180 degrees to point toward the street. And when they knew the coast was clear and there was nobody else around, they flashed their headlights 3 times. Nothing. They waited, and then they flashed the headlights 3 more times. And it was far off in the distance they saw a tiny light, a pin light, like the faintest of stars in the sky. But it was there, and it was getting bigger and bigger. Brad's girlfriend began to panic. She felt her lungs and heart seize up, and Brad was just as alarmed as she was, watching this oncoming beam of light, both terrifying and mesmerizing. They wanted to escape, and yet they also wanted to know what it was. The pin light became a spotlight, became a bright beam like that of an oncoming train, dancing a bit left and right, up and down, but still locked on its forward trajectory, always coming at them, inevitably about to reach them. Brad and his girlfriend surrendered to panic. They shouted and fumbled in the frenzy of the moment. What do we do? What's happening? Do something. Do something. In all the fuss, they had knocked the car keys onto the dark floorboard and could not find them. Brad did the only thing he could think to do. He reached down to the console of the car and he flicked on the headlights. Instantly, the single beam, the blinding light right in front of them, disappeared. The two took a moment and they gathered themselves, and then they opened up the car doors and they got out and they walked around and they looked and looked. The light had been so close to them, right up upon them, right there in front of the car, 12 feet at most, but there was nothing there, nothing left to see. There was no source, no explanation. Brad Culp could take nothing away from that night, from that experience. nothing except the story, which he reported in the campus paper the very next week. At the end of his story came a challenge to his readers and a challenge to us all. If you're ever near the old farmhouse on Milford Road in Oxford, Ohio, after dark, take a few moments, pull onto the driveway, turn around, and flash your headlights 3 times. And wait. Wait for the oncoming light. For whatever is behind that beam was likely born of great heartache. A heartache born of great love. A love that can never again reach beyond the light. My friends, we have more ghost stories to tell, and of course, my final piece, the original work that I have prepared for you, Ghost Stories 2020, continues after this. I'm so glad you're listening. Happy Halloween, my friends. Love the month of October. Nice to do something kind of frivolous with all the serious things that are happening in the world. It's funny, every year I find so much of my own sort of attitudes bleeding into the broadcast. And for some reason this year, I just feel a little melancholy. You know that feeling? I mean, a lot of the stories in the broadcast today, they're about hauntings, but they're not overtly scary. I mean, hopefully the finale will really get you, but, you know, I just feel this sort of haunted melancholy, and I think that's informed a lot of the stories that I'm telling, which is fine. I mean, I'm all about atmosphere. I like to take people on a journey. I like to experience the journey along with you. And so I hope the broadcast this month, this year, has appealed to you in that way. There's a lesson in this next story, a lesson that I will leave for you to discern. What I'm going to tell you here is absolutely true. It's not true in the sense that I'm trying to create atmosphere by claiming that it's true. This is a real thing. And that makes this tale all the more interesting. It was the early 1840s in Hydesville, New York, the home of Mr. and Mrs. Bell. There was a knock at the door, and a salesman, a peddler, was standing there, and he was trying to sell his wares. Housewares, specifically. The salesman's name was Charles Rosma. The Bells invited the man inside. In fact, they invited him to stay for a few days. The peddler, Charles, was never seen again. The maid of the house noticed strange things in the days after his disappearance. Many of his housewares were suddenly now parts of the Bell family kitchen. She assumed that her employers had simply purchased some things, and she thought little else about it, until she began to hear voices in the middle of the night. And then she saw a figure drifting through the house, a house which soon became locally famous for its hauntings. Years later, they found an actual skeleton within the walls, which added to the allure of the story. Now, jump forward a few years from 1940 to 1948. Two young sisters, Margaret and Kate Fox, claimed that they had actually reached into the spirit world and communicated with this man, the salesman who was presumably murdered. This man revealed to them from his ghostly unrest that he had in fact been killed by Mr. and Mrs. Bell for the $500 in his suitcase. The two sisters told this story every chance they got. Constantly, famously, they attracted believers and debunkers who would watch their seances and either believe or disbelieve the bumps and sounds and whatever else was attributed to the murdered ghost of a man. These knocks were called spirit rappings. Imagine the shock a few decades later when the sisters, Margaret and Kate Fox, admitted that they had faked the whole thing. The seances, the knocks, these spirit world conversations with Charles Rosma, it had all been a hoax. They made the whole scenario up. even as they charged for their seance services. It turned out that even the bones, the skeleton discovered in the walls of the house, those were a lie. It was a random collection that even included a few chicken bones. These two women had tricked everybody for decades into believing a ghost story that simply wasn't true. But by that time, the Bell Cottage had already become a kind of ghostly tourist attraction. And this admission that it was all a hoax did not stop people from believing in the murdered ghost of Charles Rossma. In fact, many believed the story even more, so much so that their belief started a religion they called spiritualism. In the 1960s, a 72-year-old man, a carpenter named John Drummond, was so convinced of this story that he started building a recreation of the old Bell Cottage. He used postcards and letters and historical records to guide the construction. And as soon as the framing was done, he was already getting requests from believers and the curious to take haunted tours of the place. John Drummond was a worshiper at the Ministry of Spiritual and Divine Science. He was a spiritualist. This religion spawned out of a ghost story that never actually was. And believe it or not, there are people who still practice that religion today. Does the admission that it was all a hoax bother them? Do the revelations of the lying sisters stop them? Does the reality that it's all fiction disabuse them of their belief that the story's true? It does not. Spiritualists remain faithful. They are locked in a story that never actually happened. Their lives and their convictions and culture built upon a foundation of a 19th century charade, and yet they will not be deterred. Perhaps that's the takeaway from this story. Perhaps it's a commentary about religion and the faithful, people who are eager to embrace the fantasy even as reality knocks on their door. They'll quickly and earnestly believe in the stories of floating phantoms spun by opportunists, but they'll never believe that it was all just made up by a couple of sisters who were selling seances for fame and profit. No, for the spiritualist, like so many religious adherents throughout human history, it's true and will remain true because they believe it, and they believe it because it's true. Of course, this is not an uncommon thing. These revelations that supernatural claims are actually naturally explained. Now, I'm not trying to spoil the happy Halloween spirit here, but we are skeptics, after all, and so I thought some other examples bore mention on this show. From the town of Anson, Texas, near Abilene, there's long been this claim that if you drive up to the local cemetery and you flash your headlights, you'll see another flickering light off in the distance. Legend says that that light off in the distance is from a lantern, the lantern held by a grieving mother who lost her son in a terrible storm and continues to search for her child. There was a professor at none other than Abilene Christian University. He decided he was going to try and replicate this ghostly encounter and determine the origin of the light. And so he went to the cemetery. He took several students with him. He took a GPS tracker and binoculars. And sure enough, the Anson light did appear after dark. Turns out it was a headlight from a distant highway. Case closed. In 1912, the H family moved into their new home, and they immediately started experiencing real trauma. Phantom sounds, they saw apparitions. Their lives descended into a kind of depressive madness. Sleepless nights, they had visions by day. The spirit world, in a state of unrest in their very own home? Not quite. An examination of the H family home revealed that the faulty furnace was releasing carbon monoxide gas into their house. What are the symptoms of carbon monoxide poisoning? The symptoms include weakness, sickness, and hallucinations. William Mumler made a really good living back in the 1860s. He was a spirit photographer. William was made regionally famous when he developed a self-portrait. And in that portrait, there was the ghostly image of a young girl in the background. William then started advertising his services, taking spirit photos for other families who had lost loved ones during the Civil War. It was weird, though. People started noticing that the figures appearing in these spirit photos, well, they often resembled people who were relatively well-known and still alive. That skepticism did not prevent William Mumler from landing a photo session with none other than Mary Todd Lincoln, the widow of Abraham Lincoln. And no surprise, the developed photograph showed the shadowy figure of Abe Lincoln himself in the background. The photo, by the way, had been totally altered. But did Mary Todd believe this? Did she think that her dead husband had come back to visit her? We honestly will never know for sure. One more. A popular legend out of San Antonio, Texas, has it that back in 1938, there was a bus filled with children that was stalled on the railroad tracks and then struck by an oncoming train. All of the children inside the bus died. Since that time, it's been reported that if you park on the tracks at that very spot, your car will be pushed backwards off the tracks, apparently by the ghosts of the children who were killed there. Of course, after decades of folklore had passed, somebody went and actually surveyed the area, and they discovered that the tracks and crossroad were on a slight incline. And those haunted child spirits were actually nothing more than gravity. On top of that, the story the legend is based upon, well, it didn't even happen in San Antonio. There was a train collision with a school bus that killed 23 students back in 1938, but that incident happened in Salt Lake City, Utah. There's actually a memorial at the site, and interestingly, that accident prompted a total restructuring of our rail systems, with new railroad crossing laws, mechanical railroad crossing arms, mandatory stops for all bus drivers at every train track. And it all started December 1st, 1938. You know, it's fascinating when you peel back the layers of the onion. Yeah, sure, there are things in this world that remain unexplained. But sometimes, when you apply a little diligence, skepticism, and some detective work, you find yourself at a whole other destination. When you're walking the stairs, do you ever count the steps? I mean, sometimes you'll look at a long stairway and you just think, wow, there must be X number of steps up there. And sometimes you'll actually try to count them, right? Well, perhaps you would be interested in the story of 100 Step Cemetery. It's a real place. It's actually called Cloverfield Cemetery. It's 40 miles west of Spencer, Indiana. There are steps. They're made out of stone and they're embedded in the ground. And they go up this hill into the old graveyard. Near the top of those steps, there are two large trees, and those trees provide a kind of frame that look like a natural doorway through which you can see a big field. And so you walk up the steps, but be careful if you're walking those steps at midnight. Now, there aren't actually 100 steps. That's just what people like to call them. It's what they like to say. In fact, it's really up to you to determine the number of steps. And if you walk those steps at midnight at the very top, it is said that you will be greeted by the groundskeeper's ghost, and that ghost will show you a vision of your future death. And then the groundskeeper's ghost will point its finger and direct you back down, and you are commanded to count the steps as you walk back down. 1, 2, 3, 5, 12. 15, 27, 35, 50. How many steps? How many steps were there? Did I miss one? Did I lose count? Oh, you don't want to lose count. Because at the bottom, the groundskeeper is going to ask you, he will speak from the top of the hill, and he will say, how many steps? And you say the number out loud. And if you're right, your future death will not happen as predicted. But if you are wrong, if you got the number wrong, you missed a step or counted too many, you will be doomed to the death which was foretold. Oh, you're going to be clever and skip the steps outright. You're going to walk down the hill instead of using the stone staircase. This is not advised, for this act will summon the devil himself. And he will appear just behind you, and he will take his hand, and he will push you down the hill, and he will leave on your back a permanent mark of Satan's handprint. And then, for the rest of your life, wherever you go, you will be literally marked by the beast until that predicted day of your death. So count the steps, my friends. Count slowly, count accurately. Because at midnight, at the very top, at 100 Step Cemetery, the groundskeeper awaits you. And the number of steps you give could change or potentially end your life. Haunt me. Catherine, I miss you. I lie here every night missing you. The warmth of your touch, the melody of your sweet voice, the sounds that you make when you drift throughout the house. Can you haunt me? Haunt me tonight. Catherine, I've done everything I know how to do. I cooked your favorite meal and I set it on the table. I brewed your chamomile tea with milk and just a little bit of sugar. I played your favorite songs from the old discs in the player. I laid our wedding clothes on the top of the bed. I'm so glad we kept them. You used to dance through the halls, down the stairway, through the rooms, through every day. Oh, you could make this house come alive. And now, some nights I wait for you. I wait until I can't wait any longer, and I walk the halls in the darkness and the cold, and I rattle the doorknobs and spin the chandelier and open the closets and close them again, over and over, listening to the creak of the hinges echoing throughout the house. I leave the silverware scattered strangely across the countertop, and I push the pieces over the edge to hear the clang upon the tile. I stop the pendulum of the grandfather clock with my fingers, holding it to one side, time standing still until I decide to open my grasp. I drag the chairs across the floor and I turn them and I tip them over and then I return them to unusual places where they had never been before. I'll go up to your portrait on the wall and I'll tilt it to the left or to the right, leaving you askew and oddly comforting as you cock your head toward me as if asking me a question. I do these things, wanting it to be you. I look around at the strange and disrupted space. I pretend it's you, but no matter how much I pretend, I know it isn't you. Haunt me, Catherine. Please haunt me. Perhaps there's no greater ghost than loneliness. The empty bed, the empty chair, the empty room, the silence. Beyond this house, I know no one, no one of consequence, certainly no one who'll sit and watch and listen and care as you always did. So much has been said and written and sung and preached about love, but words do it so little justice. How can words describe this swell in my heart when you would reach out to hold my hand as we walked along the sidewalks? As you leaned backward when I walked up behind you and I put my chin on your shoulder and I would whisper in your ear and I would kiss you on the cheek. As you spoke no words and yet said so much in the eye contact that we'd make from across the room. You knew my routines and I knew yours. You finished my sentences and I finished yours. You shared my life and I shared yours. No words could ever do this justice, and now that you're gone, it seems that words can't even reach you at all. Is there a ghost so frightening as loneliness? I've been desperate, I admit. I've clawed my fingernails into the wood. I yelled a frightening cry into every corner of this place. I shattered mirrors. Then I took the shattered glass and swiped at my flesh and shed my blood upon the walls. I've been so desperate, so cold, so empty. Sometimes I didn't even recognize myself. I take no pride in this. We are not meant to live this way, to exist inside shells, talking only to ourselves, cheated of the gift of sharing the moments, the memories, the oxygen and the breeze and the sunlight and the storms, the touch and the laughter and the sorrow and the healing, the times when we look at each other to make sure we're not the only ones, and in the sharing of those things, we become one with the moment. Yes, Catherine, I don't fear the world of the dead. Not the phantom, the ghoul, the spirit, the ghost. No, I don't fear them. Because I know, with my whole heart, I know that those things aren't nearly as frightening as a life without love, without touch, without warmth, without words, without someone. More terrifying than rattles and clangs and shrieks and crashing and whispering and footsteps and reflections in the corners of my eyes. More terrifying than any ghost. More terrifying than being haunted is to never be haunted at all. So haunt me, Catherine. Haunt me tonight. Catherine. 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 Catherine.
Catherine.
So much has been said about the dead, the undead. You know, one thing we don't often talk about during the Ghost Stories broadcast is another kind of life after death. The moaning and shrieking and rotting undead. The zombie. There was a guy named Burley Vang, and he wrote a short poem called To Live in the Zombie Apocalypse. I just thought it was really good. He said, "The moon will shine for God knows how long, as if it still matters, as if someone is trying to recall a dream. Believe the brain is a cage of light and rage. When it shuts off, something else switches on. There's no better reason than now to lock the doors, the windows, turn off the sprinklers and porch light, save the books for fire. In darkness, we learn to read what moves along the horizon, across the periphery, of a gun scope. The flicker of shadows, the rustling of trash in the body of cities long emptied. Not a soul lives in this house, and this house, and this house. Go on, stiffen the heart, quicken the blood. To live in a world of flesh and teeth, you must learn to kill what you love, and love what can die. I have questions about the zombie apocalypse. Like, we all know it's coming. Like, what else could happen? You know, I mean, of course, you know, there are no surprises. Man, bring on the zombie apocalypse. When you are a zombie, is there any part of you that is actually left? Like, do you retain portions of your personality? So if I am dead and then become undead and I get up and I walk the earth, are there semblances of my former life? Can you see a hint of the former Seth in the zombie Seth? I have questions about this. When the zombie walks from place to place, I don't know, it depends on your zombie lore. Are they eating brains or flesh or whatever? But do I have memory? Can I remember my former life? Do I yearn for the land of the living? Do I consciously seek out flesh for nourishment to sort of partake in the life, in the living things that I left? I have questions about zombies. Do I get tired? Do I ever sleep? Do I ever stop to sort of recharge the body? Because I'm usually in motion, I'm shambling through the alleyways and across the houses and into the buildings nonstop looking for nourishment, but that means that I require sustenance. Do I ever need to sleep? Do zombies sleep? I have questions. What happens if a vegan becomes a zombie? You're vegan in your life, and it's still you in your undead state. You're supposed to eat flesh? Is this not a violation? Why don't the zombies ever eat each other? I mean, it's all flesh. At the end of the day, I would think rotten flesh would be easier to chew and digest. And what happens after you eat? Do zombies ever poop? You're eating, there is input, you are taking something into your zombie body. What happens to everything they eat after it runs through your undead digestive tract? Are zombies immortal? What happens when the flesh totally rots away and you are nothing but skeleton? Do you simply fall apart? Can an animal become a zombie? You know, a dog is bitten, a hamster or squirrel is bitten. Can they become zombies? What happens if the apocalypse presents you with no food? You've gone through all the canned goods and everything you can find in the abandoned stores. Let's say you eat a zombie. Will that infect you and then you, in fact, become a zombie? How do the undead detect the living? Is it all line of sight, or can we be smelled? In other words, if I hold totally still and a zombie walks right in front of me and I say nothing and I hold my breath and I make not a sound, will they simply keep walking, or am I detected in some other way? I have questions. I have questions about zombies, my friends. No doubt we shall encounter many of the walking dead. We shall see zombies once again on this coming Halloween. In just a moment, I'm going to play for you the final story of Ghost Stories 2020, something I've written and produced just for you. So you got a few minutes to get situated. Find a good spot where you won't be interrupted, where you can turn the lights down and crank the volume up, and take the journey with me. The finale of Ghost Stories 2020 is next. Okay, here we go with the finale of the broadcast. Again, thanks to all of my players and actors and consultants and everybody who helped to put this particular tale together. It is my encouragement to you that if you can't block out 20 full minutes without interruption, that you just sort of plant a flag here and come back. I also recommend turning the lights way down and sort of locking yourself into a space where you can turn up the volume and really enjoy yourself. The story is called Mystery at 10,000 Feet. And happy Halloween, my friends.
On August 4th of this year, the Federal Aviation Administration made public the recording of an exchange between West Air Flight 227 and Tucson, Arizona Air Traffic Control. The West Air plane had departed St. Petersburg, Florida for a four-hour flight westbound. Before departure, the 737's manifest logged Captain Jonathan Miller, co-pilot Daniel Torres, three crew members, and 147 passengers. This is the official FAA recording of what happened that day.
Air Canada 460 Heavy, Tucson approach, turn right, heading 140, descend to 15,000.
Right to 140, 15,000, Air Canada 460.
West Air 227, descend 8,000 and maintain 250 knots.
11,000 to 8,000 and 250, West Air 227.
Air Canada 460 Heavy, contact Tucson Tower 118.3.
118.3, Air Canada 460 Heavy.
American 370, fly heading 280. You can intercept final approach for runway 29er right.
29er right, American 370.
West Air 227, Tucson approach. I'm still showing you above 10,000. Descend and maintain 8,000. Reduce speed now to 250. West Air 227, respond.
Jesus. Did anybody else see that?
West Air, I have you at 35 miles. See what exactly?
We just hit a massively bright light. Advise nearby aircraft. Find out if anybody else saw what we saw.
Stand by. American 370, I've got a report of a flare of some kind in your vicinity, maybe 12 miles to your northeast. Did you guys see anything?
That's a negative approach. We didn't see anything.
Thank you, American 370. Cleared visual approach, runway 29er right. Contact tower on 118.3. Good day.
29er right, 118.3, American 370.
West Air, I still see you above 10,000. I need you at 8,000. Speed 250, heading 280. Expedite, please. West Air 227, confirm, please.
Standby approach. We're working some instrument troubles here.
Roger that. United 751, change heading. Left 210, descend 5,000. I've got a 737 pretty close to you. I'm going to get you under him.
Descend and maintain 5,000 at 210. United 751.
Did you guys have anything to report? Did you see a bright light or a flash or something unusual like that? I've got a West Air that said something about a light.
Yeah, negative on the light. We did catch some turbulence about 3 minutes ago. Toss us around a bit, but we didn't see anything.
Thank you, West Air. Talk to me, advise on the instruments, and descend to 7,000 as soon as possible. West Air 227, if you can hear me, ident. I need a supervisor here, please.
Hey, what's up?
Yeah, I've got a West Air not talking to me. They said they hit a big flashing light or something. Got some instrument trouble. You want me to stay on this?
Yeah, hang on. West Air 227, West Air 227, respond. West Air 227, if you can hear this transmission, try reaching us on guard frequency 121.5. Stick with them. Let me get everybody else out of the way. Keep me advised.
You got it. West Air 227, I've got you now heading southeast, heading 170 at 9500 feet. I need you to respond, please. What the hell?
What's happening?
They just disappeared. West Air 227, I've got nothing on radar. I cannot hear you. Please respond. West Air, are you there?
They're gone. They're all gone.
West Air, do you wish to declare an emergency?
What the hell is happening?
West Air 227, is this an emergency?
Yes, it's an emergency.
All right, I need you to calm down and tell me what's going on.
There's nobody on this plane.
Okay, to make sure I'm clear, you can't confirm the number of passengers.
Jesus. There's nobody. There's nobody back there.
West Air 227, I've got your transponder back. I see you at 5,700 at a heading of 140. We're now rerouting everything around you. Please say intentions.
This isn't happening. This cannot be happening.
West Air, do you have control of the aircraft? West Air 227, are you able to control the plane? Please advise.
We've got control.
What the hell is going on up there?
This is some kind of Twilight Zone thing. We left St. Petersburg with a full plane, and there was a splash. She started acting funny, and the weight was all wrong. We lost the instruments, totally down, for about 45 seconds. We called back to the cabin. Nothing. Captain Miller had control of the aircraft. I went back to take a look. There's nobody. The cabin crew, the passengers, Tucson, we're flying an empty plane.
West Air 227, can Captain Miller confirm what you just told me?
Tucson Approach, this is Captain Jonathan Miller. I can't explain what's happening here, but he's telling you the truth. Officer Torres and I appear to be the only ones on the aircraft.
West Air 227, I've declared an emergency. Tucson International is still your closest airport. I need you to descend to 5,000. Speed your discretion. Walk me through everything that's going on.
Girl. In the back of the plane, there's a girl.
West Air, is there anybody else? Anybody with her?
No, she's by herself. I can't see her face. She's looking down at the floor. I can't see her face. Looks like she's about 25 rows back.
West Air, can you confirm the cockpit door is closed and locked?
Yeah, it's locked.
West Air, descend and maintain 5,000. Speed your discretion for Tucson runway 29 or right. I need to get you on the ground.
5,000. Speed our discretion for 29 or right. 227.
Just stick with me. I'm going to stay with you. I'll guide you in. I've got trucks on the way. I've got officers moving to your position. When you land, do not taxi. Hold on 29er right. Officers will board you on the runway. Got it?
Who are you? Oh my God, what the hell?
You stay in that seat. Do not approach the cockpit. Do you understand?
She's trying to get inside. She's pounding on the door. Jesus Christ! She's pushing her way through the door. How can she do that? What the hell is going on?
West Air 227, respond. West Air 227, confirm. I need to know what's happening up there. Emergency vehicles, I've got West Air 227 inbound on runway 29er right. I show rapid descent. The crew is not responding. Possible terrorist on the plane, trying to break into the cockpit. The crew stopped responding just a minute ago. Just be ready for anything. Cleared onto taxiway Alpha. Hold short of runway 29er right. Stay on my frequency.
Taxiway Alpha, hold short of runway 29er right. Confirmed.
West Air, it looks like you're still flying the plane. I see you at 4,400 on descent at 180 knots for runway 29er right. You're cleared to land. Can you confirm you are a go for landing? Emergency vehicles, I'm getting nothing from 227. No idea what's coming down. Keep your eyes open out there.
Affirmative, we're in position.
West Air, I'm going to guide you in. I see you on radar at 900 above ground level. 800. I see your gear is down. 600. Emergency crews are going to meet you at the end of 29er right as soon as you touch down. 300. 200. Tucson Tower, are you monitoring?
Affirmative. Tower has the West Air down on 29er right. Confirm officers will board at full stop.
West Air, I'm still with you. I'm still here. Respond.
We're behind the right side wing. No visible damage to the aircraft. Can't see any activity through the windows. The plane is breaking. Standby.
Standing by. 29er right is closed for 227. West Air 227, law enforcement has surrounded the aircraft. You are about to be boarded. Officers are armed and treating this as a hijacking. Are you able to respond? Key your handset three times if you can hear me. Squad 10, I've got no response from 227. No idea what you're in for.
227 has had a full stop on 29er right, just short of Alpha 6.
Roger that.
Tucson, we've got a flashing light visible through the cockpit window, some kind of strobe. We can't see any of the crew or anybody at all. We're gonna raise the stair truck and look inside before we go in. Stand by.
Roger that. We'll keep the line open.
It's hard to see with the flashing. No sign of the captain or co-pilot. There is somebody else. It looks like a young girl sitting in the captain's seat. I don't know, maybe 14 or 15. It's hard to tell. Can't see her face. Black hair covering her face. She's got both hands up, pressed against the windows. I can't see any weapons or anything. What the hell is going on? She's moving. Her hands are moving. She's doing something. She's looking at me. She's looking right at me. She's screaming. The girl is screaming. She's on fire. Fire in the whole cockpit. She's screaming. Get her out of there. Get in there. Get her out of there. Oh my God.
August 4th at 7:43 p.m. on runway 29er right at Tucson International Airport, West Air Flight 227 simply disappeared. This phenomenon was witnessed by law enforcement, emergency personnel at the scene, and the tower controllers at Tucson International. The disappearance was captured on TIA surveillance cameras and was investigated on site by the NTSB. It has never been explained. Moments before that disappearance, 35 miles east of Tucson International, a 737 aircraft, flames at both engines, crashed in the hills of Willow Canyon, Arizona. The fuselage ripped into pieces. The fireball could be seen from the nearby town of Reddington. Paramedics at the scene found only bodies, many still strapped into their chairs, most of them burned beyond recognition. The crash of West Air 227 yielded a single survivor, a teenage girl with third-degree burns. She was found in her seat on the 27th row, her body slumped over, her head looking down, her blistered hands raised high as she screamed. She screamed. She was screaming for her mommy.
Thanks to everybody who contributed their voices to the broadcast today. Lucy Newman-Williams, Tricia Brio, Jameson Jenkins, Eric Rogers, Sander Salagi, Brad Zephyr, Larry O'Brien, Alan Vanek, Addie Ringhofer, Brad Hyland, and I even snuck in a couple of friends and activists. You might have recognized the voices of Lloyd Evans and Andrew Seidel tucked away in there. Anyway, thanks to everybody. Stay safe out there and have a happy Halloween.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. For a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring The Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions, log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.